Imagine building a brand new house to escape crushing poverty, only to move in and realize you still have to walk to a wild river just to get drinking water.
Yeah, I mean, it's a harsh reality.
Welcome to a new deep dive. Today, we're looking at a massive 2010 South African government report evaluating their rural housing program. Our mission is to cut through all this bureaucratic data and discover whether this colossal project actually improved the lives of the most vulnerable. Okay, let's unpack this, because if you've ever managed a massive project at work, you know that scaling up too fast usually breaks things.
Right, absolutely.
But when a government scales up housing too fast, it's not a broken spreadsheet. We are talking about people living without sanitation.
Exactly. And, you know, to figure out where things broke down, we have to start with the people living in these homes. The demographics from a sample of nearly 10,000 beneficiaries are, well, they're intense.
Give me the numbers. Like, who are we actually talking about here?
Yeah. So nearly 70% were female. Over a quarter were over 60 years old. And get this, a staggering 84% were completely unemployed.
Wait, 84%?
Yeah, 84%. They were surviving almost entirely on child support and old age grants.
Wow. I mean, that economic baseline is just brutal. It's like planting seeds in completely barren soil, you know? Or I guess giving someone a high-end smartphone in a rural area with zero cell towers.
That's a great way to put it. The physical hardware is there, but the network just isn't.
Right. So if 84% of the people living here don't have jobs, are we just putting a brick-and-mortar band-aid on a much deeper systemic wound? They obviously can't afford to pay for private utility hookups. So how does giving them four walls actually fix their situation?
What's fascinating here is that the program did exactly what it set out to do in terms of targeting. It successfully reached the most marginalized folks, like women, the elderly, and the disabled.
So the targeting worked.
It did. But that extreme baseline of poverty means a physical house alone just can't generate a local economy. And that economic reality crashes headfirst into the physical reality of the houses themselves.
And here's where it gets really interesting, because the realities on the ground seriously challenge our basic definition of housing. We move from the people to the actual infrastructure now.
Right, the roofs versus the realities.
Yes, and there were wins. Over 81% of people occupy their homes full time.
Which is huge.
It is, but then you see the harsh realities. A third of these houses have zero electricity. 56% rely on communal taps. And in regions like KwaZulu-Natal, people are literally pulling their drinking water from natural rivers.
Right, natural rivers, yeah.
Wait, I'm genuinely confused. If the government funded this, how did they legally get away with putting people in homes with zero power or safe water? Wasn't there a baseline standard?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, we really have to look at the strict legal limits of the policy itself. The primary goal wasn't comprehensive town building.
Wait, it wasn't.
No, it was providing what they called functional security of tenure.
Functional security of tenure. Okay, what does that mean?
That essentially means securing a plot so people couldn't be legally evicted from communal lands. Because they had that narrow focus on legal land rights rather than, you know, integrated human settlements, the harsh reality is that simple pit latrines became the norm instead of modern sanitation.
Wow. But the lack of physical plumbing isn't the only thing missing, right? Because the systemic cracks in how the program was actually run are massive.
Oh, absolutely.
We are talking about an incredible scale here. 342 projects, almost 167,000 planned units.
It's massive.
But they suffered from severe structural defects, corruption, and this bizarre buzzword, institutional memory loss.
Yeah, that's a wild one.
So what does this all mean? How can a program succeed so wildly in volume, but fail so dangerously in quality control? And what does institutional memory loss even mean in this context?
They call it institutional memory loss, but it essentially boils down to extreme staff turnover. By the time a housing project was halfway finished, the original staff had left.
Oh, so new people just take over.
Right, and the new bureaucrats had absolutely no idea what the previous ones had promised or why certain decisions were made. The continuity just completely vanished.
That is wild. And I saw developers were getting paid just for hitting basic milestones. Were government inspectors essentially just checking a box that said the walls are up without checking if the roof leaked or a faucet actually turned on?
This raises an important question about the inherent tension between rapid government delivery and long-term monitoring. Yes, they paid contractors based on rapid milestones to speed things up.
Because they needed the volume.
Exactly. But without strict quality monitoring, you know, checking those faucets, verifying the foundations, the quality plummeted. If the oversight isn't there to enforce standards, the vulnerable people living inside are the ones dealing with dangerous structural defects.
And that is exactly why dissecting this matters so much for you, whether you're analyzing public policy or managing your own team. It is a masterclass in why good intentions and raw funding simply aren't enough without sustainable execution and rigid quality control.
Absolutely. Volume without a supporting ecosystem is just a recipe for failure. You have to build the entire network, not just drop the hardware and walk away.
Which leaves us with a final thought to ponder today. If a house is built to last for generations, but the community around it completely lacks an economic base and basic human services, does that house eventually become a geographical trap rather than a stepping stone to a better life?